Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
A warm welcome to First Move. Great to have you with us on another pivotal Jobs Friday in America. Just moments ago, the US released what can only be described as stunningly strong employment data for the month of July. Numbers that should further ease concern or perhaps even erase concern that the United States is headed for imminent recession. The US adding 528,000 jobs net last month. That's more than double expectations, with big gains in sectors like leisure and hospitality and in the healthcare sector. Also notable, the US unemployment rate, which has finally fallen to pre-pandemic levels. The jobless rate now standing at 3.5%. Here's a reaction. US futures firmly lower as investors fear the Federal Reserve will now be forced to tighten rates further again. Markets now expecting another 0.75% rate hike at the meeting next month. The Fed, of course, trying to curb economic growth to help bring down inflation. And this report shows economic growth still remains very strong, at least as far as the labor market and hiring is concerned. All right, let's get more of this in our drivers. Rahel Solomon joins me now. Rahel, the only word I can use here is wow.
That was my reaction. And to add to that reaction, Jason Furman just tweeted, uncomfortably hot jobs report. This is a really interesting time that we're all living through, Julia, because any other time you see a jobs report like this and it really just sort of spells a really strong economy, really red hot labor market. But in an environment where inflation is at 9.1%, according to the last reading, well, it sort of adds an asterisk to that jobs report, right? So, yes, as you pointed out, this was twice what economists were expecting. We were actually expecting to see some cooling in the labor market. Not seeing that. When we look at sort of where the jobs were, it was widespread. As you pointed out, leisure and hospitality, Julia, adding 96,000 jobs in the month of July. Professional and business services, 89,000. I think we can pull it up for you. Healthcare, 70,000. And government, 57,000 jobs. So the complicating factor about all of this is the demand for workers and wages. Right now, Julia, there are 1.8 open jobs for every one person looking. When you have that kind of imbalance, it creates upward pressure on wages, right? I mean, just think about it. Companies have to incentivize people to work for them because there is such demand for workers. And so they raise wages to try to incentivize workers. And while that is great for American workers, well, first of all, that's being outpaced by inflation, but that then trickles down into higher prices and it creates a vicious cycle and it makes the job of the Fed trying to fight inflation much harder. And I should point out, Julia, that inflation is so problematic that even with these wage gains we're seeing, with the exception of just two industries, leisure and hospitality and retail, every other sector is being outpaced by inflation, and that's the problem. So what does this mean for the Fed? Well, it means that we'll probably see another rate hike of 0.75% in September, but it also means that the U.S. economy, at least the labor market, is still red hot, not showing signs of slowing down.
Yeah, it's so important to listen to the signals because I always remind myself that 99% of the employment in the United States is small and medium-sized businesses. So we listen to the signals that we get from those that have the loudest voices and the biggest megaphones, which is tech companies, which we know are sort of looking at slowing down the pace of hiring. But for small businesses here, at least, gangbusters. There you go. That's another word. Inexplicable.
Wow. Rahel. Gangbuster, red hot, yeah. Uncomfortably red hot.
Yeah, exactly.
So many
people
ways
get
to
the
describe
message.
This report.
Yeah. Rahel, thank you. Rahel Solomon. Okay, China flexing its military muscle and political muscle too, suspending cooperation with the United States on a range of issues, including climate. It comes as Taipei reports fighter jets and warships in the Taiwan Strait. This, of course, all following U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to the island earlier this week. She's now in Tokyo for talks with the Japanese Prime Minister. Selena Wang joins us now. The military drills, of course, continue, but now the response in terms of not only sanctions, direct sanctions, of course, on Nancy Pelosi, which you can talk to us about, but on something, one of the few areas where the United States and China were still trying to cooperate on tackling climate change.
As a result of this, we are seeing U.S.-China relations, Julia, sink to new lows as if they couldn't get any worse. China has announced that they are suspending bilateral talks with the U.S. on a whole wide range of issues. This includes topics including illegal immigration, anti-drugs. This includes on military discussions and also, most importantly, as you say, on climate change. This was one of the few areas where there were still ongoing dialogue between the two countries despite the ongoing tensions. And this is bad news for the whole world. These are the two world's largest contributors to climate change, and they need to have these discussions. But as a result of the fallout from this Pelosi visit, they are not. China has also said it's sanctioning Nancy Pelosi and her immediate family over what they are calling this provocative, reckless act that is challenging China's sovereignty. They have not released details on that, but it is a major symbolic move. This, of course, comes on top of all of the military escalations from China. We've just learned, according to Taiwan, that they have flown a record number of warplanes into Taiwan's air defense identification zone. This is the airspace around Taiwan. While China frequently flies warplanes in there, today we learned there were 68 in a day. That is a record number, Julia.
Yeah, Sina Wang in Beijing. Thank you for keeping on top of that for us there. Now, Russian President Putin hosting Turkey's President Erdogan this hour as the two leaders meet for the second time in less than 3 weeks. The summit in Sochi comes after Turkey helped broker a deal to restart grain shipments from Ukraine. The Kremlin says they will discuss the deal as well as trade ties and potential energy projects. Nada Bashir joins us now from Istanbul. The fact that these two leaders have met twice in just under 3 weeks, I think, is important. It's also setting off alarm bells that perhaps the Kremlin is looking to strengthen economic ties with Turkey, of course, a NATO nation, particularly in the energy sector. And I think the risk is here that perhaps it will provide Russia with the opportunity to disguise the origin of these oil exports as the EU crackdown on oil imports finally kicks in next year. Nada, it's a valid worry.
Absolutely, Julia. That is expected to be a key focus of these talks now between President Putin and President Erdogan. As you highlighted there, we have seen them maintaining that dialogue, that communication quite frequently now over the last few weeks and months. We just heard, just ahead of those closed-door talks between the two leaders, President Putin making a few brief remarks saying that he hopes this meeting will allow the two leaders to establish some sort of agreement to strengthen those economic ties between the two nations, focusing on various aspects of economic relations, but as you said, they're in particular on energy cooperation. But also, of course, this is the first meeting between the two leaders since we've seen the Black Sea Grain Initiative being put into practice. And that was something that President Putin was careful to mention. He thanked President Erdogan for his work in mediating that agreement. And this really has been seen by President Erdogan and the Turkish government as a bit of a diplomatic win for Turkey. We've already seen one ship, the Rezoni, that first shipment of grain from Ukraine's southern Black Sea port of Odessa, successfully passing through that carefully identified safe corridor, passing its inspection here in Istanbul before making its way to Tripoli in Lebanon. Today, a further three ships departing from Ukraine's southern Black Sea ports on their way to Istanbul for those inspections, carrying nearly 60,000 metric tons of grain. So this has been a significant development on that front. And of course, as you mentioned there, Russia may now be looking to Turkey not only to support them in mediating those sorts of resolutions, but also now to strengthen those economic ties. Turkey, while being a NATO member, hasn't joined in imposing sanctions on Russia. So as Russia begins to feel the bite of these Western sanctions, they may now be turning to Turkey to perhaps support them on that front. But this isn't the only thing on the agenda today. There are a number of topics. And what is primarily on the agenda for President Erdogan, I have to say, is a focus on a potential incursion in northern Syria. This would be the fourth incursion by Turkish military in northern Syria since 2016, the most recent one we saw back in October 2019. President Erdogan, of course, his aim remains the same. He is looking to establish a safe zone, in his words, a buffer zone on Turkey's southern border, ridding the region of Kurdish allied militant groups the Turkish government deems to be terrorist organizations, and a secondary goal to that, then allowing the movement of Syrian refugees currently settled in Turkey voluntarily to these parts. But of course, that incursion we saw in 2019 triggered widespread condemnation by the international community. It is still a major goal for President Erdogan, and this is important because, of course, Russia has significant stakes in Syria. It still has a military presence in northern Syria. It controls much of the airspace in that region. We saw President Erdogan attempting to really gain Putin's support back just a few weeks ago, meeting with both President Erdogan and meeting with President Putin and their Iranian counterpart, Ibrahim Raisi. The Kremlin thus far has said it doesn't support the incursion, but of course that will be a key topic today in those talks. President Erdogan trying to get the green light from Moscow to push ahead with this incursion. Julia?
Yeah, I mean, there was so much in there and obviously so much to talk between them. I think the danger for Turkey on the potential energy negotiations that I was talking about in the beginning is the risk of triggering secondary sanctions on Turkey. So that's something to worry and certainly be concerned about as well. But good to hear that more vessels have left Ukraine with that precious grain as well. So we'll continue to follow that too, in addition to everything else. Nada, thank you so much for that, Nada Bashir. Okay, let me bring you up to speed with some of the other stories making headlines around the world. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky hit back at Amnesty International on Thursday after the human rights group said Ukrainian forces endangered their own civilians by putting troops and equipment in residential areas. President Zelensky said the report is helping Russia get off the hook for its crimes.
We saw today a completely different report from Amnesty International, which, unfortunately, tries to amnesty the terrorist state and shift the responsibility from the aggressor to the victim. There are no, and can be no, even hypothetically, conditions under which any Russian attack on Ukraine becomes justified.
President Zelensky also accused the group of practicing, in his words, quote, immoral selectivity. Russia is reportedly ready to discuss a potential prisoner swap now that a verdict has been reached in Brittany Griner's drug smuggling trial. Griner's lawyers say they will appeal the 9-year prison sentence a Russian judge handed down on Thursday. The WNBA star pleaded guilty to taking less than a gram of cannabis oil to Russia. And a lightning strike has killed two people near the White House in Washington, D.C. Medics say the victims were sheltering from a thunderstorm under a tree in Lafayette Park. Two other people were critically injured. There's no word on their current condition. Okay, straight ahead, as the U.S. declares monkeypox a public health emergency, the World Health Organization calls on Europe to do more. Its regional director joins us. And costly content. Warner Brothers Discovery say streaming is underpriced as it merges HBO Max and Discovery Plus. We have the latest on that report. Stay with us. Welcome back to First Move. U.S. stocks remain on track for a lower open after the release of today's stunningly strong U.S. jobs numbers. The U.S. reporting within the past hour that 528,000 jobs were added to the economy last month, more than double expectations. The big question is whether today's numbers will put that to rest, concerned that the U.S. economy is headed for recession. The report surely represents a source of concern for the U.S. Federal Reserve, which wants to see a moderating pace of jobs growth to help ultimately bring down pricing pressures. U.S. profits are another source of economic strength. S&P 500 companies on average are reporting more than 12% sales growth and more than 8% profit growth this Q2 earnings season. The number of companies beating on the top and bottom lines have surpassed 5-year averages as well. Julian Emmanuel joins me. He's the Senior Managing Director at Evercore ISI. Julian, great to have you with us. I tell you what, this doesn't say anything for the economists and the analysts, whether we're talking about predictions of corporate earnings or jobs numbers.
This is a tough job in a bear market. It's easier in a bull market. But, you know, look, this is actually the kind of dynamic that we have seen in different forms since the beginning of the pandemic. The issue here is that the economy globally is so unpredictable that you just get constantly these wide variations in expectations. You know, look, how do you possibly reconcile two consecutive negative GDP quarters with the employment report we just saw 45 minutes ago? It's very challenging.
I'm glad it's your job and not mine. Does that mean that there's going to be revisions to those quarters and that we'll see a bump up in the numbers? Because I think it is very confusing for people to understand. Perhaps it's less confusing, at least in the short term, for the Federal Reserve, because they have a mission to bring prices down. They have to hike interest rates and they will continue to do so. The idea that they could cut rates next year, which is what the market initially was pricing, to me just seems absurd based on these numbers.
No question about it. Look, we've made very clear that our view is that the one thing the Fed must avoid is a situation where, and this is sort of, you know, the rate hiking cycle has now become a bit more complex, although clearer, but there's this Goldilocks element to where you cannot hike so far that you precipitate the kind of recession, not that we have right now, but that the yield curve is telling you we could have in the back half of 2023, to the point where you would be tempted, as was the case in the 1970s, to cut rates into that kind of downturn without inflation having been subdued significantly enough. It's a very difficult task.
I guess my other question here is just how tight policy is or isn't, quite frankly, because we're reducing the balance sheet and we're raising interest rates, but from incredibly low levels. And while we've got out of the psychology of seeing rate hikes and we've had easy money for as long as everyone can remember, given the last few years have just been so long, outrageously long in terms of what we've been through, do we have to just get a grip and understand that these jumps are really big because the Fed has waited so late to hike rates, but it's okay. And perhaps the jobs market at least is telling us that.
The jobs market is, you know, it's one of those things where our view was, is that to a certain extent, good news would be good news. This is a bit too much good news for certainly the yield markets, which, you know, part of the reason 2022 has been as painful as it's been for equity investors is because after 25 years, bonds and stocks are now moving together. Yields go up, stocks go down. And that's sort of what's going on right now. But again, putting it all together, look, there's an element that says is that particularly if you're a stock picker, the fact the Fed is starting to normalize policy from really multi-decade lows, and it's happening around the world, is very good for finding investment opportunities that have long-run differentiated potential. And ultimately for us, the fact that free money goes away may be painful in the present, but is likely long-run a very good thing.
Yeah, if we look at the very short term, and I'm always reticent to do this, I'm talking about literally the day's moves. What we're seeing, though, once again, to your point, is a market that's pricing in more hikes, not less, and that means bond prices come down, and we're seeing stocks go down. So for the average investor, where you have a lot of money in stocks and you have a lot of money in bonds, this is incredibly painful. It's actually been great for the past month because we've seen bonds going up and we've seen stocks going up. Unfortunate correlations, but it works for the average investor. And then before that, it was really uncomfortable. So I guess, Julian, my question is, for those people that it works when things are going up, it's incredibly painful when it goes down. How do you invest? And for those that were hoping perhaps that we'd seen the bottom of the sell-off in stocks in particular, have we?
So we think in all likelihood we have not seen the bottom in stocks in this cycle. Now, what this does, this kind of environment makes, you know, emotional challenge, you know, beyond what you see when you open your financial statement. As an investor, you need to be committed to the long run case for stocks. And there is historical evidence that stocks can still advance in times of high inflation. You need it to crest, and we do think inflation is going to crest this year, but you can have it advancing. So, but the other aspect of it is psychology, right? If you look at the bull market that we've had since the financial crisis, you have been rewarded to buy every pullback of 20 to 30% or what have you. This environment says, you know, be prepared to buy those pullbacks. If you don't see yourself a buyer, if we go through those June lows, that means you own a little bit too much stock now and you should probably trim. You need to be psychologically ready. The other important thing here, Julia, is that cash is not at all a liability. It is an asset, even with inflation where it is now. It enables you to be a buyer of those dips where you need to do that to really secure long-run investment performance.
Dry powder, I think it's called. Interesting
exactly.
Point to make.
Exactly.
What proportion, Julian? I mean, I know, as you said, it's difficult to gauge because it's based on people's comfort levels. But what proportion of the money that you perhaps have available to invest, however small, should be in cash at this moment in your mind?
Well, that really comes down to, you know, your age, your risk tolerance, your investment horizons. People's cash levels tend to be anywhere from, call it, 0 to 10%. And our point of view here is that the number right now, particularly given the degree of the rally we've had the last month, is that number should be skewing towards the high end, again, in preparation to be deployed if stocks set back, with the knowledge that even if we're wrong in our view that they won't set back over the next number of weeks, that your cash levels will actually fall if stocks continue to advance.
Yeah, it's a great point. Always great to have you on the show, Julian. Thank you so much for that. Julian Emmanuel, Senior Managing Director at Evercore ISI. Okay, now to a streaming switch, and the boss of Warner Brothers Discovery says cinemas get the priority when it comes to new releases. David Zaslav made the comments in an earnings call where he announced massive losses and laid out plans to merge streaming services HBO Max with Discovery Plus. Just for context, Warner Brothers Discovery is the parent of CNN. Brian Stelter joins us now with all the details. Brian, I'm glad we've got you on this because there is a lot to talk about. This is a mixed quarter for me because it's part of the old business, it's a part of the new business, so it's always going to be a little bit messy. You're always going to see some element of kitchen sinking, I think, in these kind of quarters and the quarter following. But I think a lot of focus has gone on what the future for streaming is and also what Zaslav had to say about where he sees it.
Yes, and Zaslav's main message was long-term thinking. As much as we talk about quarter by quarter, and Discovery is doing a lot quarter by quarter to try to trim the business, he was focused on the next 3, 5, even 10 years. Zaslav announcing that merger of HBO Max and Discovery Plus will begin to happen this time next year, summer of 2023, and it'll then roll out in various markets around the world. He talked about 2025 goals, and he talked about the future of DC films. Of course, the superhero collection of characters that would like to challenge Marvel more aggressively. He talked about a 10-year plan for DC Comics, for DC Films, for bringing some of those characters to life. And he talked a lot about trying to protect those assets and brands. I think a lot of what we're seeing right now, Julia, is a reversal of the prior administration. Jason Kilar, who was running WarnerMedia for AT&T, who said it was all about streaming, who said we're going to take films out of theaters, put them only on streaming. Those were big, expensive bets that were made in 2020, and they're now being reversed by Zaslav.
Yeah, and he's saying, look, we just don't see the economic case for that direct to streaming. So it is a significant shift. And I think that statement was weighed actually very cleanly. But also talking about the prospect of reducing churn in terms of the number of viewers and break even. Let's talk about the economics, actually, of making streaming work in an environment where there is increasing competition. And I think that's a reality check for everyone. We've seen that for other players. Netflix in particular in the past quarters, two quarters in particular, too.
Right. I think it's a really interesting argument that's being laid out by the new administration. And we will know in a couple of years whether it was the right argument or not. They're basically saying this market is so competitive, putting a film in a movie theater first creates more value, creates more allure, makes it seem like a bigger deal because it was in a movie theater. Now, that has been the logic going back 10, 20 years in Hollywood. The pandemic changed a lot of those thoughts. And that's why Kilar in the previous administration said, we're going to skip theaters. We're going to go straight to HBO Max. We're going to show that HBO Max is the future of entertainment. Now, basically, Zaslav's trying to have an all-of-the-above model, and that also reflects the changes in media company valuations, the decline of stocks, including Netflix, Warner Bros. Discovery, and Disney. These media stocks are way down. Investors much more skittish about streaming than they were 6 months ago, so that's partly why Zaslav's presenting much more of an all-of-the-above strategy. We're going to be in theaters. We're going to be on cable and satellite. We're going to be in streaming. We're going to be in everywhere. However, Warner Bros. Discovery stock did fall quite a bit in pre-market trading, rather in after-hours trading yesterday, when he was presenting. So far, there's still a lot of skepticism about the future of these stocks.
Absolutely. And on that note, let's talk about pay, Brian. Let's talk about our boss's pay, just to be clear to our audience again, the ownership structure of CNN. $246 million in 2021, and that was a jump from 2020, $37.7 million. It's a lot of money, and it's a huge project, a challenge, yes. I think, going forward, a super tanker.
It is. I've covered Zaslav for many years. He is one of the highest paid CEOs in America. The argument goes like this. His mentor, John Malone, pays his CEOs incredibly well, mostly through stock, through options that only become available if you get the stock price up and up and up. And that's been the idea behind Discovery and Zaslav's pay for years. Relatively low base salary, huge opportunities in terms of hundreds of millions of dollars for stock. You can see why Malone thinks it makes sense. However, some of those laid off HBO executives, it bothers them quite a bit when they read about these inflated salaries, not just at Discovery, by the way, but also across the media sector. Yeah. It is one of those tension points that always exists in the media world.
Yeah. Huge upside in the share price, incentive effect to do better and to boost that share price up. But as you said, this is not a one corporate story. This is across the sector and there are questions being asked. Brian, great to have you with us, as always.
Thanks.
Brian Stelter there. All right, coming up. Monkeypox multiplying. The United States following the WHO in declaring a public health emergency. The global response to the outbreak and what more is required next. And welcome back to First Move. And as expected, U.S. stocks are firmly lower in early trade after today's blowout U.S. jobs report, pretty much wiping out any chance of a Federal Reserve policy pivot anytime soon. As we've been discussing, the bottom line, interest rates likely to stay higher for longer. And that, of course, not good for Wall Street. The U.S. reporting a much greater than expected 528,000 jobs added net. Last month, more than double expectations. The U.S. unemployment rate also falling to pre-pandemic levels, too. However, lots of other news and important news that investors are following this Friday as well, including a breakthrough for U.S. President Biden's more than $700 billion economic plan, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. Senator Kyrsten Sinema offering critical support for the bill after party leaders agreed to change some of the legislation's tax-raising provisions. The bill allocates more than $400 billion to programs that help ease prescription drug costs and climate change. And fears of a deep freeze in relations between the U.S. and China, the two largest global economies, could represent new headwinds for markets. China announcing after the Asian close that it will cut cooperation with the United States on climate change and limit military cooperation, too, as part of its condemnation of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan. Now, in other news, as monkeypox continues to spread around the world, the United States has declared the disease a public health emergency. White House COVID-19 response coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha explaining the Biden administration's effort to tackle the outbreak.
We have 1.6 million people. There's no reason to think that 100% of everybody will want the vaccine, but we are going to try to target making sure there's enough vaccines for everyone. At 1.6 million people in the high-risk group, we've got 1.1 million doses already allocated in, to states. They can order it. About 600,000 have gone out. States are going to be able to get more this month. We've got another about 200,000 doses coming in September, another about 500,000 doses coming in October.
There are more than 7,000 confirmed cases in America. That's more than any other country. But it comes after the World Health Organization issued its highest alert over the outbreak last month. Globally, nearly 27,000 monkeypox cases have been reported across 88 countries, and Europe remains the region with the most infections. Joining us now is Dr. Hans Kluger. He's regional director of the World Health Organization in Europe. Dr. Kluger, fantastic to have you with us.
My pleasure.
We've seen the United States now declare this a public health emergency, but as you look at the infection rate that we're seeing, perhaps the lack of cases that we don't know we've got at this stage, has the response been swift enough and aggressive enough in your mind?
Well, I think that several lessons from the COVID-19 have been taken into account. So it's very important that there was a public health emergency of international concern. I would like to commend the United States government for having it now as a national emergency, because what does it allow? It's a call to action, and it allows to target resources to contain the outbreak. And that's the main aim that I'm here to forge, this transatlantic cooperation, because we see that a crisis anywhere can become a crisis everywhere if unattended, and both regions, just like COVID-19, are the epicenter in the world.
Can I ask about, and I mentioned it in my introduction, for all the cases we know about, do you have an estimate even if it's a guesstimate, of how many cases that we don't know about? What kind of proportion? Because this is also a lesson that we learned from the COVID-19 pandemic, that for every case we know about, there can be multiple that we don't.
Absolutely. Speaking about the pan-European region, we have about 17,000 cases now. This is clearly the bulk globally, but we call it the tip of the iceberg. So two key issues here. To limit the infection, number one is to sensibilize the high-risk groups. And in the European region, like globally, it's mainly in the group men having sex with men with multiple partners. Very important to avoid stigma and discrimination, because otherwise people are going to go underground and will even have a lesser ID of the total number. And number two is to target the vaccines and the treatments to those high-risk groups.
Do you have a sense of a baseline level of how many people that you think will get infected, in the same way that we heard there from the White House's coordinator on COVID-19? They said that the high-risk group is 1.6 million people in the United States. They have 1.1 million vaccines available today. Do you have any kind of estimates for Europe, even if it's just the high risk, the proportion of people that are high risk?
Well, it's a specific target group, but it does not depend on sexual orientation, because what we're seeing now is also cases in children, in women as well. So basically, everyone is vulnerable. But a key issue, I think the biggest thing to tackle, is the stigma and discrimination. And we should remember, after all, that the transmission is not so easy. It requires close contact, skin to skin, mouth to mouth. So in that sense, the calling of an emergency is very timely, because what we don't want, for example, is to have a reservoir in animals, in rodents, which then can really sustain the monkeypox outbreaks in the future.
Dr. Kluge, I think you said something incredibly important there about the stigma attached to monkeypox at this moment. And I think so far the message has been targeted to specific communities, and specifically men who have sexual intercourse with other men. And the message has been that they need to limit those sexual partners to try and avoid infection or spreading the infection. Are you saying actually that that's now the wrong message, and that everyone needs to be careful, particularly if we're seeing children be infected? And who should be vaccinated, and how do people best protect themselves, whoever they are?
On the vaccination, an important point here is that vaccines alone are not going to stop the outbreak. It's either what we call pre-exposure or post-exposure, and it takes about 2 weeks to build up the immunity. So it's a very important tool, but not a panacea. The key issue, frankly speaking, is the oldest public health tool that we have, and Portugal in my region has shown that you can have a decrease of the cases even in absence of wide vaccination by sensibilizing the high-risk groups. And for this, we need to empower trusted messengers and fight fake news and disinformation, which is a lesson we learned from the COVID-19.
Yes. So everybody needs to be careful here and yes, be prepared and be aware. And it's not just specific communities that yes, should be targeted, because to your point, that does raise the stigma attached to this. And I think we've unfortunately established that today already. I want to move on and talk about COVID, because I know you're also raising the flag about an increase in cases, particularly as we head into the winter months. And we're already seeing rising cases. And again, many we're not capturing because people, I think, are tired of testing. How important is it to time the message from governments and the response from individuals? Because I do feel there's a window where you can say to people, look, you need to wear masks again, you need to be more careful. But people are exhausted. And if we want to get this right, the timing on what we ask people to do has to be very targeted. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Basically, what we see in the European region and also globally is that people stabilize their lives, but without stabilizing the pandemic. The virus has never gone away. It's still there. It keeps changing, and it's still taking unnecessary many lives. So the key issue here, I would say, is surveillance, because information data is power. Several countries are weakening their testing strategies. They do not make a difference between reporting people going to the hospital due to COVID or with COVID. We developed in Europe 5 pandemic stabilizers. Number one is a full vaccination. Number two is the second booster for high-risk groups. Basically, if you haven't had your shot this year, you should consider yourself vulnerable. Number three is ventilation. Far not enough attention has been given to ventilation in classes, in office buildings. We don't want to close the schools again. Number four, if need be, in confined, crowded places, to consider masks. Even now, I am wearing the mask. It's not because it's not obligatory that you should not consider it. And number five is to scale up equal access to the new antivirals to avoid people getting onto the ventilator.
Yeah, good messages, sir. Great to have you with us, and hopefully we'll talk again soon. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Hans Kluger there, the regional director of the WHO Europe. So thank you. Okay, coming up, flexible solutions to finding work. The CEO of InstaWork with insights into the jobs market on a key wow day for the US job growth in America. That's next. Okay, welcome back to First Move. Let's get back to those blowout jobs numbers for July. In the United States, leisure and hospitality added 96,000 jobs net. That's of particular relevance to InstaWork, which matches more than 3 million hourly workers to open positions across the United States and Canada. Hospitality is a key sector for the business, along with vacancies in warehousing and logistics. To discuss how it all works, Samir Meghani, he's InstaWork CEO and co-founder. Samir, fantastic to have you on the show. It's like a dating app, actually, for matching hourly workers with opportunities out there for firms that need their required skills. Just explain who's using the app and how it all works.
Well, good morning, and thanks for having me. Yeah, InstaWork is the leading flexible work app. We connect thousands of businesses, sports stadiums, retailers, e-commerce companies with millions of qualified, you know, professionals. And right now, we think we're filling a very critical need in the local economy. It's literally as easy as, you know, pros who are workers, they download the mobile app, they create a profile, tell us their skills, when they're available, and then they'll get notifications as jobs open up. You know, a job on InstaWork could be as short as 6 to 8 hours on one day or several days or several weeks. The one unifying theme on InstaWork is flexibility, which is, you know, our pros have complete control over where and when they want to work.
I think it's also important for our viewers to understand the scale of the opportunity here, because when we often talk about the post-pandemic work environment, we talk about people working from home or Zooming in or doing that kind of activity. But for what? Around 100 million workers, you have to be present for a job in the United States. And we're talking about 1.8 vacancies equivalent for every person actually looking for a job. That matching and provision of flexibility is crucial in this labor market at this point in time.
Absolutely. And it's funny, Julia, you know, we're a tech company, and a lot of companies right now, including InstaWork, are trying to figure out, you know, do people want to work from the beach, or do they want to travel and take their laptop with them? And as you mentioned, you know, if you're a bartender, a forklift driver, you don't have that choice, but what we're hearing from our pros is they're demanding flexibility in other forms, the ability to navigate, you know, their work schedule, you know, around their family, right, or to be able to travel and work jobs in different cities. And to give you a sense of the data we're seeing, you know, we were at about 1 million pros signed up for InstaWork last March in 21. This March in 2022, we were at 2 million. And just 5 months later, just now, we've hit 3 million pros. And so our pros are speaking with their swipes. You know, they're downloading, you know, the app and signing up. And I know you covered the jobs report earlier. You know, we're at record low unemployment, 3.5%. So, you know, these workers have many choices on where they're going to spend their time. The fact that they're choosing, despite a hot, tight labor market, to be on InstaWork, you know, is a sign that flexibility is the new norm for all workers, right? Not just digital workers, but for everyone.
So how does it work in terms of a business comes to you and says, look, this is what I'm looking for. These are the skills requirements. You have loads of people that upload their skill set. How do you vet them? How do you ensure? And how do you manage the feedback what proportion of people that sign up for a job, perhaps the business comes back and says, actually, this person was not that great and they didn't arrive and they didn't do this. And then what do you do with that person? Do you give them a second chance? How does vetting quality of work and employer, let's be clear, work on the platform?
Yeah, and you highlighted something really interesting, is that there's sort of vetting on both sides. And
right.
For the first time, you know, hourly workers, you know, they have a choice on where they want to work, but they also have a voice. They're able to rate the employers, just like the businesses on InstaWork are able to rate workers. But to your question about vetting, you know, all of our professionals have to, they download the mobile app and they go through a multi-step process. They upload pictures of the relevant work attire, any certifications they have that might be required for specific positions, for example, a bartending card or a forklift certificate. They have to upload their work experience, right? So they're building a profile of record on InstaWork, which is part of our long-term, you know, strategy. And only about 10 to 15% of people who try to sign up are actually approved to get on, because it is a pretty rigorous, you know, sign-up process. And then after that, you know, it's a two-way rating system. And the benefit for business is that the more ratings they give us, you know, our technology and our platform will help get their shifts in front of the right people who we think, you know, are a good fit. And then on InstaWork, there's an incentive for our pros to do their best work. You know, our average wages on InstaWork are $19 an hour. You know, our pros make on average nearly double their state's minimum wage. So they get high pay and they get instant pay. And so within 20, 30 minutes of when they clock out of a shift, that money is on their debit card and in their bank account. And so the better you do on InstaWork, the higher ratings you get. It's a meritocracy. You're able to earn more, right? Get paid quickly. You're able to upskill, and combined with the flexibility, it's a really, really compelling value proposition for the 3 million pros we have.
Yeah, and we should make the point that in many of these places, the average wage is higher than that minimum wage. It's just they've not changed the rules on the level of it for, you know, years and years and years, because Congress can't get its act together. But your point is that they earn more than perhaps they would out there if they were acting alone and not through this app. One of the other things I like to the flexibility is that people can sign up for different jobs. So you were saying that a person can be a bartender one day and a forklift truck operator the next day. So it's also the variety, depending on circumstances and what you're available to do and where, I think that also is fascinating. How do you make money? Do you charge the employer when they manage to hire people? And are you making money? I know you're in growth phase and you're scaling up, but talk to us about some of the economics for you, too.
Yeah, the businesses pay us a fee when there's a successful match. So right. If someone shows up and they do a great job, that's only when they pay. And so our business is aligned with, you know, with the successful outcome for both, you know, the partners and the pros. Our pros don't have to pay anything. That instant pay feature I mentioned earlier is completely free. So all they have to do is have the skill and the will to work, and they're able to make, you know, really high income and get that flexible pay. And we're growing quickly. As you mentioned, you know, we're a growth stage company. We've got some amazing investors. It's been important for us to have, you know, great sort of fundamental unit economics, you know, to make sure that our marketplace is balanced. You know, businesses are paying rates when there's a match that are reasonable and commensurate with what they normally pay. And our pros are making, you know, far more than they might be able to make on their own. And so we think that's a great thing for the economy.
Yeah. And I like your point about the aligned incentives, that you only get paid when the worker does a good job, not just because you match them with an employer and then your job's done. So you're incentivized to have the right people and to make it work, which makes sense. But it's nice to see you getting paid on that fact, too. Sumir, great to have you with us. Keep us posted. I want to talk expansion plans as well, because I think other countries could use you too. We'll talk again soon. Sumir Moghani.
Yeah, we just founder. Launched Canada. We announced Canada.
Yeah, I know. And you. Onwards. Great to chat to you. Sumir Moghani, CEO and co-founder of InstaWork. Thank you. All right, after the break, a brewing crisis. The UK faces pricier pints for beer as the cost of grain continues to rise. Welcome back. The Great British Beer Festival is back after a long pandemic pause. Though troubles may be in store for the ale industry, war in Ukraine is jeopardizing its most important ingredient, and that, of course, is grain. CNN's Issa Suarez reports.
After a two-year hiatus, the Great British Beer Festival is back. And there's plenty to celebrate. With nearly 1,000 cask ales, craft beers and ciders under one roof. It's a welcome return for an industry that has seen restaurants close and bars struggling to stay open.
We haven't seen each other socially for quite a long time, so it's just a great place to come, have a few beers and chew the fat.
But trouble is brewing, as the UK, like many countries, faces the knock-on effect of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Brewing is a high-intensity production process. You need to boil your water, your malts, your barleys together and mix them all together at high temperatures. So you do need a lot of energy to do that. And it's pushing up their costs very highly. There's other factors like fuel costs, delivery costs, the crisis we've got in the Ukraine, and that's affecting grain prices.
And it's not just grain. Russia's invasion has also caused energy prices to spike, rising 70% from June of 2021 to June of this year.
Everything is being affected. And if I'm honest, I don't think we're really feeling the squeeze of that yet. I think the squeeze of that really is to come in the next 12 to 18 months.
It's 520.
But the reality of these costs has left a bitter taste in some people's mouths, with more than 50% of the British public saying the average price of a pint, now around $5, is unaffordable. But as I wander through the halls of this festival, it's clear the thirst for beer is not going anywhere.
So how does it feel to be back after 3 years of COVID?
Absolutely brilliant. Loving every minute of it. And great to see everyone under the same roof again, enjoying great cask ale.
And while the outlook may look cloudy,
Anthem, please. Anthem. Yeah, go. Anthem.
For now, these brewers clearly still have a glass half full.
Cheers, thanks very much. Cheers.
Isa Suarez, CNN, London.
Tough gig. That's it for the show. Connect the World is up next. Have a wonderful weekend and we'll see you Monday.
Now streaming exclusively on Max. A new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.